Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck.
Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Welcome, welcome, welcome one and all to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast where we talk about vinyl records and all things of interest to the record collecting community. My name is Nate, and I am very excited about this week's episode because guess what? It's not just one episode this week, but there are two episodes this week. Yep, that's right. This week, you will be getting two episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast. One today, on Tuesday, and the other on Thursday, 2 days from now. Think of this as my Guns N' Roses Use Your Illusion phase. Those two were released on the same day. Maybe like what System of a Down did with Mesmerize and Hypnotize. Anyway, look, there's a lot of content to get through, and it was hard to put it in one. If I put it all in one episode, it would have been like a two-hour episode, so I decided to chop it up a bit. There's a lot to cover, a lot to talk about. The episodes this week are all about bootleg records, something many of us may have in our collection, many more may be interested in. And depending on who you ask, bootlegs can be either a terrific addition to your collection, or they could be a complete pox amongst the record racks. The diametric opinions are understandable. Bootleg records were of variable quality. Some sound like directly out of a studio, approved by the artist. Others sound like a muffled tape recorder inside the jacket of someone inside a mosh pit. So you never know who's kind of behind the bootleg operation. Some of them are great. Some of them are dreadful. But for the next two episodes of The Vinyl Guide, we are going to be talking about bootleg records, not so much to try to change your mind or anything, but really just to introduce new ways about thinking of bootleg records and just influencing a dialogue on the subject. So let's start off with a definition. What are bootleg recordings? Bootlegs are recordings of material from an artist that isn't commercially available to the public for purchase. Now, this is very different than, say, a pirate or a counterfeit record, which really is just a cheaper version of material that is available commercially. Bootlegs represent a desire for fans of artists to hear more material, to go beyond the released material and hear the artist in various and perhaps lesser controlled environments. Bootleg recordings are often associated with live performances, but many early boots are full of rare tracks by the artist or alternate takes or various takes or even false starts. And if you're lucky, you get some studio chatter in there as well. There's some incredibly interesting recordings of Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys instructing his session players on the type of feel that he was wanting to get out of a performance when they were recording the song Good Vibrations. There's some bootleg recordings of John Lennon and his early demos of Strawberry Fields Forever, where he's experimenting with the tempo and the pace. These sort of recordings allow fans another view of their heroes, and they get to be a witness to the creative process. Many bootlegs show the performer in a more authentic and human light, often working through mistakes, making decisions, just generally being human. And that reduces the space between the artist and their fan base and makes them all the more endearing. Also important to note is the subject of bootleg and record counterfeiting is a topic that we're going to start discussing more and more, not just on this podcast, but in general. It's easier than ever to make your own record or to copy an existing one. I put up a video on the Vinyl Guide Facebook page, which is facebook.com/vinylguide, of a guy showing you just how to do that. Now, I don't think he's being nefarious with it, but it really just shows how easy it is to copy a physical record with materials that are more and more common. And for anyone who is following the rapid progression of technologies of 3D printing, it's not a stretch to think that at some point in our future, we may all have the ability to press records within our homes. In fact, that may be the preferred method of vinyl distribution in just a decade or two. Go to an artist's website, pay a fee, download an encrypted file that prints a single physical copy of a record, which you could play on any turntable. Techno nerds and hipsters, each satisfied by a single transaction. So today's episode will be all about bootlegs. Again, recordings that aren't available for the public to purchase. In part one of our two-part series, that barrier preventing the purchase is the artist and the record company. However, in part two, which comes out on Thursday, we'll look at what happens when the government creates that purchasing barrier. We'll be speaking with Stephen Coates, a musician and an author of a very fascinating book called X-Ray Audio, The Strange Story of Soviet Music on the Bone. and Stephen will tell the strange but true tale about how some records were circulated in the Soviet Union with severe penalties to those who were caught circumventing the laws. So with that, let's strap in and let's talk about bootleg records. The beginning of the bootleg record industry was undoubtedly 1969's The Great White Wonder, a compilation of various performances and rare studio tracks from Bob Dylan. However, the beginning of what spawned the bootleg industry was much earlier. In the early 60s, Bob Dylan rose from coffeehouse minstrel to New York and global sensation and spokesperson for the culture of disenfranchised youth, many of whom in the U.S. were facing potential draft into the army for a growing military presence in Vietnam. Before this, young men and women just pretty much did what they were told, didn't question the need to fight an enemy they'd never met. However, with the baby boomers now coming of age to fight their own war, Dylan's perspective appealed to them. He challenged the status quo with his lyrics. He stood for what he thought was right. Dylan spoke his mind and refused to work for those who wanted to control or curtail him. Just ask Ed Sullivan. When his censors tried to edit Bob Dylan before the taping of a show, Dylan just walked out. His message was not just music, but he spoke to the culture of the day. It was important. It was meaningful. It's hard to find a modern-day equivalent, perhaps a politician like Bernie Sanders, just striking a chord with his supporters. But that's how important Bob Dylan was to the young record buyers of the day. Collectors easily consumed all of his LPs. And once those were thoroughly devoured, they went looking for more. Most fans, however, just had to accept the approved output of the artist. However, there were others who did some detective work, dug further, and were occasionally rewarded for their efforts. These people were tape collectors, or tape traders, who existed in an underground economy mostly managed in those days by word of mouth. One guy knew a guy who knew a guy, and eventually they met, compared lists, and swapped what they had to fill the holes in their collection. People made and shared lists, mailed them to other collectors across the country, and they bought and traded with like-minded fans everywhere. The format of choice to trade tapes for these collectors were reel-to-reel tapes, as they presented a very strong quality which the infant format of cassettes couldn't achieve until the early 70s when Dolby made it a practical substitute for tape and audio archivists to use. There were underground tape trading clubs, friends made dubs for friends, but most of the additional non-release material at the time was from various live gigs where someone, sometimes the artist, recorded themselves and a close acquaintance was able to get a copy. This was the start of board tapes, or recordings that the artist made of themselves in an environment that they controlled, often from the soundboard of a live concert. However, tape was not a medium that lent itself to wide distribution, so these recordings remained in the realm of niche audiophiles and superfans, at least for the time being. As Dylan's career went from strength to strength in the 1960s, he succumbed to exhaustion and started relying on drugs just to keep things going. Dylan had an ever-growing set of responsibilities, including recording, touring, traveling, promoting, speaking to the press, managing backup musicians, recording contract negotiations and obligations, and various other artistic adventures. They all laid pressure on him, and he struggled, as most people would, to meet those expectations. With the pressure of immense fame and all this activity going around, tragedy nearly struck. On July 29, 1966, Dylan crashed his motorcycle outside of Woodstock, New York. He reportedly damaged some vertebrae, and he required a long period of rehab. Small snippets of this made the news. It's an event that's very shrouded in secrecy. There are very few records or news reports of this time. In fact, many speculate that it was mostly made up, and it was just a handy excuse for Dylan to get some downtime and recuperation, perhaps even kick a habit or two, at his home in upstate New York. Bob Dylan was very prolific in the 1960s, releasing 7 LPs worth of culture-changing material within 4 years, including albums such as Highway 61 Revisited, The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan, and one of the first rock double albums, Blonde on Blonde. He also changed the view of the singer-songwriter to the music industry. He had no use for hired hitmakers or anyone in the Brill Building. He wrote and promoted his own material with his own voice and his own perspective. Where he started off reworking traditional songs written by others, he now created his own, he spoke his own mind, and quite frankly, didn't give a toss about what others thought. So in 1966, he wasn't going to let anything as significant as a motorcycle accident derail his creative streak. Dylan spent the better part of a year at his house outside of Woodstock, New York, with fellow musicians, jammed, and worked through various song ideas. This body of work later became known as the Basement Tapes, but at the time, they were never meant to be enjoyed outside of his inner circle. Over a year after his motorcycle accident, Columbia Records quietly released a new Bob Dylan album called John Wesley Harding, an LP that sounded distinctively different than all of Dylan's pre-accident material. John Wesley Harding was fairly rustic and sparse, and Dylan's anger seems to have significantly subsided. The album sold well, and it charted high, and in fact, the following year, Dylan released a second album, Nashville Skyline, which went even further into the country sphere and continued to alienate his fans. At a time when the war in Vietnam grew hotter, Dr. Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy were assassinated, the civil rights movement and riots are all around the United States, it seemed the spokesperson, who so well represented the early disposition of the youth, was starting to grow soft. It seemed like the youth would now have to look elsewhere for someone to represent their fire. What many people didn't realize was that during his year-long recuperation after his motorcycle accident, Bob Dylan was still writing music, and brilliant music at that. He just had no intention of recording it himself and subjecting himself back to the pressures of touring and traveling and press and everything that went with it. Dylan was so burnt out, but that didn't stop his inner fire. He wrote some tremendous tracks during that time, and he certainly knew it. He just didn't want to get back into the center of the storm. So Dylan recorded these songs, not for himself, but to sell. He made demo versions of these songs for a publishing company to share with other performers. Dylan would let other bands and artists perform his songs, and he, as the songwriter, would retain the publishing rights and, of course, the lion's share of the proceeds. This was an excellent plan to keep the money coffers full, to keep Dylan busy and out of the day-to-day pressures of being a performer. And of course, Dylan being Dylan, every band wanted a shot at recording his work. It was one thing to do a cover song that everyone already knew was written by someone else, but it was an entirely different thing altogether to be the first performer of a song written by such a genius. And it all worked like a charm. In 1967, Dylan's publisher struck gold with a version of Too Much of Nothing by Peter, Paul, and Mary. Months afterward, Manfred Mann used one of these publisher demos to record the track Mighty Quinn, which promptly topped the charts in both the UK and the US. That same year, both The Byrds and a one-off band, Julie Driscoll, Brian Auger, and Trinity, scored hits with the song This Wheel's on Fire, another Dylan track which many listeners may be familiar with as the theme to the awesome television show Absolutely Fabulous. To facilitate the artist recording Dylan's music, his publishing company would work quietly with the band's management to share sheet music of these songs, and if it was helpful for the artist to hear Dylan's version of the song, there were even acetate discs that were pressed up of Dylan's actual demos that the artist could listen to. Now, the artists were restricted to only listen to these demos inside of the publisher's office. However, occasionally these acetates got outside, and when they got in the hands of superfans, they made tapes and passed them around like a good rumor. Tapes of these unheard Dylan tracks made their way to several collectors across the country who relished this material. Here were Bob Dylan songs that were more in line with the material that they loved on albums like Blonde on Blonde. And since Dylan was using the band to back him up on the demos, and they continued with him on more recent releases like John Wesley Harding, these recordings seem to be a very reasonable bridge between the pre- and post-motorcycle accident periods. Eventually, tapes of these acetate demos made their way to two enterprising individuals in California, Ken Douglas, and Dub Taylor. Dub Taylor and Ken Douglas were tape collectors in California and huge Bob Dylan fanatics. In the late 60s, they were absolutely enthralled to receive copies of the unreleased, unheard Bob Dylan publisher demos. So excited, they decided it would be fun, and possibly profitable, to combine these publisher demos along with several other prized and unreleased Bob Dylan recordings they had and print up a few thousand records. And luckily for Dub and Ken, California had an absolute abundance of record pressing plants and, at the time, very little governance and oversight as to what they pressed. Whereas today, record pressing plants are very cautious for the person ordering records to prove ownership of the music, in the late 60s, hardly anyone paid attention to that. Dub and Ken got their Dylan record pressed. It was a double album with all the unreleased tracks, each with a plain white label and a plain white cardboard sleeve, no text, no images, nothing to suggest that it was Dylan on the grooves within. It was only when a shop suggested they name it to make it easier to sell did they start calling it the Great White Wonder, and they had a stamp made to press those words onto the plain white cover of each sleeve. To their pleasant surprise, copies of Great White Wonder sold out very quickly, and reorders started rolling in. Demand for Great White Wonder was high, thanks not only to the Dylan drought caused by his motorcycle accident and recent country music transformation, but also because tracks from the Great White Wonder started being played on commercial radio stations all across Southern California. People called in and wanted copies of Bob Dylan's version of these hits they'd heard from recent years. And there was pressure from many sources, including an editorial from Rolling Stone editor Jan Winner, to plead the case for Columbia to release these recordings officially. If there's anything that history has taught us, it's that the record industry has its head firmly up its own ass. Columbia Records responded to the Great White Wonder bootleg as expected, first by trying to sue the makers of the LP, Ken and Dub. However, they didn't know who made the record since each one was in a plain white sleeve. There was no address or name or record company there. Then the record companies tried stopping the actual record shops from selling copies of the Great White Wonder. However, threatening the people and the stores who also sell the rest of your company's music catalog is a rather short-term strategy. What the record companies didn't realize is that they were also somewhat on thin ice legally. First, the Great White Wonder LP had no reference to a Mr. Bob Dylan, no text, no imagery, and no proof that they were knowingly making a Bob Dylan record. Additionally, many of the live tracks on the LP were recordings made before Dylan even signed with Columbia, and the publisher demos Dylan made in upstate New York were from a point in time where he may have been in between contracts. And to even top that, the laws at the time stated that only the copyright holder was allowed to sue, not the record company. That is, if you could find the bootlegger to begin with, which they couldn't. Ken and Dub kept a very low profile. However, that didn't mean they stopped the presses. Ken and Dub, under the name TMQ, or Trademark of Quality, started making other boots from their tape collections. They released more tracks from their Dylan archives and even branched out to other artists. They released the Rolling Stones' Liver Than You'll Ever Be bootleg from a Stone show in Oakland, California, that Dub recorded himself by sneaking a reel-to-reel tape recorder into the show. By now, the hype of bootleg records was undeniable. Teenagers who had these records were like local heroes. They had music that no one else had, and it was a badge of honor to own a copy of something you shouldn't have. It was like giving a middle finger to the authorities. Record shops would run out of bootleg copies as soon as they arrived. You had to know someone who knew someone to get one, and it was a huge victory when the time finally arrived where you could take one home. With this kind of hype, other bootleg operations sprang up. The Beatles' failed Twickenham session recordings, which were nabbed by a sound technician hired to help film the group, were being circulated on a bootleg record before they were officially compiled into the album Let It Be. Elton John's performance was bootlegged from a radio simulcast before it was released, partially anyway, as the album 11-1770. Many of these new bootleg operations were run by amateurs, and some were caught and put out of business near immediately. Other operations started printing addresses on record sleeves of cities around the world in an attempt to throw off the scent of any authority who attempted to track them down. Detroit, London, Paris, when in fact, the majority were still being pressed out of the record plants in Southern California. Aside from the music and the marketing, the cover art of bootlegs also started to evolve. Originally, bootleg records were sold in plain white sleeves with stamps and titles and artist applied later. This way, the intent wasn't exposed to the people working in the printing plant who made the cardboard sleeves. However, then paper covers started to be affixed to the plain white sleeve, boasting the artist and the songs on the record. This originally started as single color, photocopier quality, but eventually and rapidly progressed into four color, full art worthy of a commercially released record, often compiled by art students who worked in secret for cash money. Bootleg records became a viable business and a real thorn for the record label and the management types, who felt that these, quote, illegal recordings were somehow taking food off their tables. And as what typically happens, the record labels go from angry to opportunistic. Initially annoyed, resentful, and even litigious towards bootleg records, it soon became apparent that bootlegs were actually quite a good vehicle to sell product. Record companies started making albums that gave the overall impression that they were bootlegs to attract attention and fire up the interest in the kids. Now, just take a look at the cover art of albums like The Who Live at Leeds or Aerosmith Live Bootleg to see where they were heading with that. The record companies also realized that bootlegs were a great way to break a new artist. By simply simulcasting live concerts on radio stations across the country, you were pretty much guaranteeing that somewhere a bootlegger was running his tape recorder, and owning a copy of this new artist would be a tantalizing prospect for the bootleg-buying public. Bruce Springsteen is such an artist. The magnetism of his live shows could only be done one town at a time, but with radio and bootleggers spreading the word for him, he opened up to a much wider audience much faster. One artist that took it upon himself to stop the bootleggers in a particularly novel way, as you'd expect, was Frank Zappa. Now, Frank was an artist that absolutely inspired collectors. Once you had all of Frank's officially released stuff, you'd naturally start to reach for the bootleg stuff. However, being a man with a strong sense of social justice, Frank found the more popular bootlegs of his work and, where he could, pulled his own personal copies of the clear soundboard tapes of those same shows, often with much better fidelity. Frank then re-released them, all with the same bootleg title, the same bootleg artwork, but with much better sound quality where he could, and he sold them for cheap in a series called Beat the Boots. And this goes to show you can always count on Frank Zappa to think differently. Now for you record collectors out there, let's talk about collecting bootlegs. This is a very tough area. Now, first off, I mean, obviously there was no record companies, very few catalog numbers, or matrix numbers is a bit of a mess. A lot of it was done in secret. There was no names, very little to trace back and determine the quality of a specific bootleg. Now, an example of what I'm talking about is Bob Dylan's Great White Wonder. Initially, Ken and Dub made this from the very best tape masters they had. However, when other people heard it, other potential bootleggers heard the Great White Wonder, there was nothing to really stop them from taking Ken and Dub's Great White Wonder and getting their own pressed. There are so many bootlegs that are just re-recorded generations of other bootlegs. And in fact, some bootleg manufacturers used the same pressing plates of other bootleggers with the permission of the record pressing plants who knew what was happening and just wanted to make a few extra bucks. So many bootlegs are unidentifiable. However, there are a few companies, a few trends that you should probably know about. Now, the first of which is TMQ, or Trademark of Quality. Now, TMQ is the pseudo record label started by Dub Taylor and Ken Douglas. Now, as the first movers with Great White Wonder, they established a channel of record shops, and they reap rewards and plowed the revenues back into creating new product to sell. Now, Ken and Dub absolutely love music. They were tape traders and collectors from the very beginning, and they put a lot of effort into ensuring a reasonable quality product. Now, TMQ releases are properly vetted by Dub and Ken, and they had a great record for being able to put out good, listenable bootleg copies. Now, you could identify later pressings of TMQ releases by the logo of a smoking pig on the labels. However, just be warned, logos and artwork can be copied too. So just because it says TMQ and has a smoking pig logo does not mean it's an original TMQ product. Now, after the initial success with The Great White Wonder and a few other popular titles, the shitty copycats got into the bootleg game, and with poor product, which burned customers and made them additionally cautious of bootlegs, Ken and Dub decided to organize. And now, they formed TMQ as a bit of a brand, standing for, like I said, trademark of quality, essentially giving customers a reasonable guarantee that they weren't buying something that was unlistenable. Now, they started actually assigning matrix numbers, starting with 71,000. Why they picked that number specifically, I have no idea. But eventually, Ken and Dub had a bit of a falling out, which left Ken to start his own label, confusingly also called TMQ. And, to top it off, he used many of the masters that Dub created for the original TMQ for his new TMQ label. Are you confused yet? Well, yeah, it gets kind of twisted here. Essentially, anytime Dub and his new business partner would come out with a new bootleg, Ken used his connections at the record pressing plant to come out with the exact bootleg using the exact same stampers and artwork, usually for cheaper. So, there's truly no honor amongst thieves. Another quality bootleg provider was Tarkl, T-A-K-R-L, which stands for the Amazing Corny Phone Record Label, and it was started, again by Ken Douglas, after parting ways from TMQ. Again, Tarkl has high quality output and a very diverse catalog, which includes Zappa, Bowie, even Linda Ronstadt, many taped from radio simulcasts. Tarkl used matrix numbers starting with 1900 and put a great deal of effort into their packaging, many issues looking quite legit and often confused with official releases. However, again, just because it says Tarkl doesn't mean it isn't a bootleg of a bootleg. So buyer beware. And if you really want to dive into the deep end with bootlegs, I suggest you get your hand on a copy of the book Hot Wax, and that's wax spelled W-A-C-K-S. This is a book that's been in circulation for nearly 3 decades and is a compendium of reviews of various bootlegs. Now, it'll tell you what's good and what's crap. In the 70s and 80s, a copy of Hot Wax was a valuable addition to any collector's library, as were the quarterly magazine updates. However, you could look most of it up online now. Hot Wax even has a website with an online database complete with heaps of info, including the source from each recording. Now, unfortunately, the website doesn't appear to have been updated since 2011, so unfortunately, that may go away at any time. Now, these days, most of us take bootleg tapes for granted. Any of us can go see a concert on a Monday, and by Friday, search YouTube and you'll probably find a multiple camera video of the show online. With smartphones and miniature digital recorders, recordings of shows going public is pretty much a given now. And many artists actually see bootlegging as it truly is, an activity rooted in affection. Owners of bootlegs aren't the enemy. They're generally such deep fans, they just want more. Providing these recordings are yet another connection point between the artist and the fan that some bands, like Grateful Dead and Pearl Jam, have leveraged extremely effectively. Artists also use the internet now, or iTunes, to distribute unreleased material. Do you want to hear Nina Gordon of Veruca Salt sing an NWA tune that she will never release on any album anywhere? Well, just go to her website, download it, and show your friends. And oh yeah, while you're there, notice the tour dates of her band, and maybe grab a ticket. It's just all part of the ride. The record companies almost always get it wrong initially, and it takes them years to turn around. Bootleg records were not a problem. They were a solution that the money men just didn't see right away. Now there's a fondness for it all, and a nostalgia, and thanks to the internet, it could be exploited effectively. But before then, they were just a couple of guys who were big Bob Dylan fans and just wanted to hear more of their hero. And by the way, we should probably add, Bob Dylan has since released everything he recorded in that Woodstock era, originally in bits and pieces, but eventually he released every note. You can hear every take, every misstart, every mistake, every bit of dialogue. Nothing was left that wasn't sold. And when the Basement tapes sold strong, Dylan commented that he thought everyone who wanted these already had them. Dylan was just late in discovering the strength of his fans. They had so much love for him, they would buy everything all over again. And that is the overwhelming reason people buy bootlegs. So that concludes the first of our two-episode series on bootleg records. Make sure to tune in for Thursday's episode as well. Cheers.